Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Bobby Franklin. Bobby is the president and CEO of the National Venture Capital Association, otherwise known as NVCA. Bobby, welcome to the podcast.
Christian, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I admit, our pleasure. When I found out you were in queue, I got genuinely excited. Because I know the NVCA has its finger on the pulse of the Venture Capital Association, and I knew by consequence our audience would be in for a treat.
Well, I hope not to disappoint.
This is gonna be a great episode. So why don't we just start? You know, I'd love to know, or share with our audience, you know, what's the NVCA's mandate and your focus?
So, first of all, NVCA started back in 1973, so we've got a long history. And it started with some of the early investors, who I call pioneers of the industry. And they were spending time in Washington focused on a couple of policy issues that went their way. And they realized, and in fact, most people point to the birth of the modern day venture industry to two policy decisions that were made in the 70s. One was to lower the capital gains rate so that there was a greater differential between ordinary income rates and capital gains tax rates to encourage long-term capital formation. And the second was a change of the ERISA rules that allowed pension funds to be investors in alternative assets. And so if you look back, most historians will point to those two things, and that's really when venture started to explode. And the early pioneers realized they wanted to be part of an industry, so they created the National Venture Capital Association to essentially work on public policy. And so, been around a long time. And I think of our job, I often describe our mission as we're the lobbyist for the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And while most people kind of have an idea what that means, in Washington, it is so important because, frankly, policymakers really don't understand where companies come from, how things are innovated, like what, how it all works. I've had people who ought to know the difference in positions of power, unfortunately, ask questions like, I don't understand why an entrepreneur goes to a VC. Why don't they just go to the bank and get a loan? And when you hear that and you realize they're in charge, you think, oh my gosh, boy, do we have a mission. And that is to make sure those who are making decisions that impact our industry greatly have a better understanding of what this industry is.
Yeah. You know, I would like to think that that would be a minority of lawmakers, but I have a feeling you're going to tell me it's not the case.
It's not. And so first of all, think about your average member of Congress. They have to make decisions on lots of issues, right? And not many of them came from this world. There are a few kind of handful of examples that understand it well. But you're put on a variety of committees that you may or may not have interest in. You also aren't here that long. I mean, there was the turnover rate of members of Congress. I know people like to talk about term limits, and you know, and certainly there are examples of people, certainly in the Senate and elsewhere, that have been around a long time. But the vast majority of Congress turns over fairly regularly, and their staff turns over even more regularly. And they have to depend on their staff to educate them on the issues that they're making decisions about. So it's a treadmill for us to be up there. We'll be up there in just a few weeks doing a VC 101 with a friend who's a professor at the Darden Business School at the University of Virginia. He and I have done several of these kind of 101 briefings where we ask staff to get together and we really try to give them the basics and try to, you know, kind of do a big education push. But you could do three a year and you would still be reaching people for the first time.
And is that, would you, I was going to ask if that's a day in a life, but maybe that's a quarter in a life of the NVCA.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely on a cadence of sorts. You know, we try to do a few of them a year. And then the day in the life, that's a great question. Certainly, we have folks on our team that are up on Capitol Hill pretty much every day
Okay.
when they're in session, or even when they're not, because when they're not, that's really when you get a chance to spend time with staff. But we're constantly pushing, monitoring, advocating what's happening on our priorities. And there are tons of priorities. I mean, this is not an exhaustive list. In fact, list is even out of date at this point. But like, there's a whole matrix of issues that we sort of think about that are important to the industry that we've got to kind of keep tabs on. Some things you've got to be thinking out a few years in advance. You say, okay, I know there's going to be a tax bill. I've got to start imagining kind of what the issues are going to be. I've got to be ready for it. I've got to be thinking and even starting my advocacy either in a defensive mode or in an offensive mode. And we play both whenever we can. We like playing offense more, but we have to play both on a variety of issues. So it's constant.
I would think, though, that if you ever meet resistance, it's generally out of ignorance,
Yes.
not spite. But I have to ask. I mean, are there genuinely detractors who want to see the asset class restrained?
I'm not sure anybody necessarily wants to see asset class restraint. I think the problem is we get conflated with everything. And so if you, I fear this is the case. If I were to ask the whatever the typical staffer or the typical member of Congress was, if they weren't on a committee that like a banking committee or financial services committee or something like that, if I were to ask them, what do you know about venture capital? I'm pretty certain they couldn't tell you the difference between a venture capital fund and a hedge fund or a private equity fund. That's even if they knew what a private fund was. And more often, I'm not sure they could tell you the difference between, they would just conflate you with Wall Street. You're just capital. You're big banks or you're the stock exchange or you're, you know, something like they just put you in a bucket. And that's the biggest challenge. That we sometimes get lumped in with many others. And, you know, once you understand our industry, you realize how different we are than many of those other players in capital markets. And so that's our sort of constant challenge.
So, it's encouraging that it sounds like it can be distilled into education. And then, as you point out, the challenge is just the turnover. Or it sounds like, the reason why the NVCA has been around for the 70s, because there's, I mean, I think we're biased. I think, entrepreneurs and innovators are the lifeblood of this country. And so to create an environment where you can enable them, but at the same time acknowledging that there's a tremendous amount of risk in the early stage. I mean, I would be, I'd be curious to know. I mean, how many parallels are there in the de other developed nations? Or are we really just unique as an ecosystem?
Well, we are unique. I feel like we invented it here. I have a meeting that I attend every 18 months or so with my counterparts from around the world. And, you know, you can look at the data. You can meet with those who run the Venture Capital Association of insert country name. And you look at it, since it was invented here, and certainly look maybe 2 decades ago, we probably had 80 to 90% market share. So if you looked at all venture capital dollars around the world, 80 or 90% went into US startups. When you look in more recent years, it got down to kind of 50%. So half the venture deals were outside the US. In the last year or so, I think we're at 63 or 64% of kind of total venture dollars. What's happening this year and all the AI deals and all that kind of stuff? It'll be interesting. It could, you know, change somewhat. It might go up because so much is happening in the US. But it certainly is. I mean, we are the 100-pound gorilla on the planet when it comes to kind of venture capital activity. And I think that's tremendous. And, you know, our job is to make sure policymakers know and appreciate that. This is where the innovation happens. This is what keeps us competitive with other countries. This is essentially the outsourced R&D arm of every industry. And I think, it's important to remind policymakers of that. There's no more Bell Labs. There's no more all the innovation happens in some lab in some big Fortune 500 company. That's not where it is.
Yeah, I mean, you start to reflect on it, you can absolutely see how someone who's not dialed into the space may not have an appreciation of what the world looks like or where innovation is coming from. I'm curious, politics aside, I mean, how much do you attribute to the current administration for the recent bump from 50%?
Well, the bump from 50 up to 63, I would say that's probably 3 years old. I don't necessarily see that as I wouldn't even call it something the U.S. did, because if you look at our data, it's a steady increase over a long period of time. So the mean is definitely up and to the right. I think what happens in other countries more determines what percentage market share they get overall. I think we've been on a steady trajectory up.
Well, with that, as I think about that, I'd be curious to know the concentration of members that are in Silicon Valley as compared to the rest of the country. And my expectation is it's large, not necessarily because there just may be a higher count of VCs in the San Francisco Bay Area, but just culturally, this idea that you have to support entrepreneurship, innovation with a unique mindset, just given the amount of risk. What do you see as you take a look at membership trends geographically?
I mean, certainly it's the 800-pound gorilla inside the U.S., right? I mean, that's where so much of it happened. In many respects, when I think back to those, many of them who I've had the opportunity to meet, I've been here since 2013, and many of the folks I met when I first got here now have passed on. But you think about those pioneers at the beginning of the industry, and a big chunk of them were located in the Bay Area. Now, there were a lot in New York. There were some in Chicago, there were some in different places, certainly in Boston, but a big chunk was there. And I think when you look into the 2000s and all that happened with the internet bubble, a lot of that was out there. And so it had a really good head start, and it's got a lot of great ingredients, but you can start to see that changing some. I mean, certainly the pandemic made a dent in it and people decided to leave. I think, seeing public policy decisions being made in California that are causing many folks to kind of locate elsewhere. So I like to see new regions, new areas, new states. I mean, I'm from the state of Arkansas. I would love it if there was a vibrant entrepreneurial ecosystem there and a bunch of venture capitalists. But, it takes time. And I think for too long, too many people are trying to say, I want to be Silicon Valley here, as opposed to really concentrating and thinking about what their region might be known for. What are they really good at? And how can they find their niche in the entrepreneurial world?
Well, you answer my next question is, thinking about entrepreneurship on a state by state basis, and I definitely think there's some macro themes. In every conversation I find on the subject with international colleagues, it's, hey, we love the U.S. because failure is accepted, and so I think that permeates the union. But to your point, I mean, yes, I've also participated in conversations of how Austin or Miami or the new Silicon Valley. I don't know how much of that is marketing. But how, in your role, how closely do you find that you're collaborating with the states? And are there any states you want to call out as, stalwarts of this idea of, hey, this is good for not only the country, but, our city, our residents?
There are a lot of states that are doing, I think, great things. I don't have time, frankly, or bandwidth to really go in and be able to call out the stars in certain states. Unfortunately, I usually get called in when there's a problem. And it is, We are the National Venture Capital Association, but from time to time we're asked to, kind of parachute into a state whose state legislatures or regulators are doing something that is not helpful to the entrepreneurial ecosystem. So we have to come in and try to help them. And frankly, that's becoming a bigger issue of late. A lot of states are getting kind of active, whether it's on tax issues or whether it's on kind of regulatory issues. Obviously, with AI, there's the whole thing about states regulating AI and should there be a national framework and all that stuff, one of our priorities. But I can just tell, having been here since 2013, that I think the next few years we are going to have to spend more time kind of engaging with some states and helping them kind of see that, look, you can certainly do things that could be helpful to attract what you want in your state, but you can very easily do things that could push them away. And it's when you just start thinking about, I mean, right now, or peering around the corner, I worry a lot about proposals that you start seeing thrown around on taxes that have more to do with paper wealth, because that will ultimately hit entrepreneurs harder than anybody else, because they're often the ones that at some point in time, there's some valuation where they seems like they're a gazillionaire. And yet we know, I often quote a study that looked at all venture investments over a 10-year period and found that 75% failed. And so if we start, as policymakers start trying to reimagine tax schemes from an income tax world to a, what are you worth on paper world, that's going to have a disproportionate impact on the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And so we've got to be that early warning system, and we've got to start thinking about how do we defend against those kind of dumb ideas as it comes to kind of innovation.
Yeah, it's someone I admire said a long time ago, common sense isn't so common. I don't think it takes an economist to understand that there's how do you not affect asset prices if you tax unrealized gains? I mean, that's nutso to me. And I would like to think that as long as we have one state who's not doing it, it would create some concentration risk if everyone moved there. So hopefully it doesn't come to that. But holy cow. Yeah, I mean, best of luck. You have my thoughts and wishes to educate those lawmakers of the negative consequences that would come trying to go down that road.
Well, the other problem is that somebody will propose something at a state level like that, and politics has changed drastically. And when I worked on the Hill in the late 80s, early 90s, and you sort of knew where Republicans were, you sort of knew where Democrats were. And that's not the world we're in now. We're in this, Trump MAGA populist world that's in charge or has the majority for now. And the other is the opposition party. And it's got this progressive, far left leaning tint to it. And the challenge that we all have is that the progressives and the populists meet around back and agree on a lot of things. And so when you're thinking about tax policy, you can have strange bedfellows that suddenly hear something, go, oh, that's a good idea. And we've already seen things at the national level introduced by the way, by in this case, senator who's been around a long time and is in a position of power on a committee of jurisdiction. So we have to take it all seriously. And, for me, sitting here watching more and more dumb ideas pop up, that's where I start to get worried about what we have to face in the coming year.
I mean, it is concerning. You would think that, I mean, I can totally understand the progressive element of it, especially in a world where, the cost of living continues to increase. It seems like it's a logical and rational solution, but, in the absence of just appreciating the actual mechanics of how that works. No bueno. I would imagine that's one of the items on that list that you held up to the screen a moment ago. I'd love to know, what are the other policy items that are near the top?
Sure. So in the previous administration, when President Biden was in charge, there was a, I'm sure folks know, the Securities and Exchange Commission was led by Gary Gensler, and the SEC had a ton of rulemakings. The most egregious, we actually went to court and sued in federal court and won, and we completely knocked out this idea that they had passed, which was to essentially micromanage the relationship between general partner venture capitalists and their limited partner funders. And it was a dumb idea, and it impacted every private fund. And so we band together, like we do a lot of things in Washington with coalitions. And so the hedge funds and private equity and us and others got together and went to federal court and sued and won. But that was one rule. And there were probably 40-something rules that he sort of passed when he was in charge. And so a lot of those we're trying to clean up. We're trying to get in a better place. We now have a chairman of the SEC and Paul Atkins, who is very friendly to private capital, to private enterprise, to, wanting to see innovation happen and everything else. And so the conditions are right to see if you can't get some of that in a better place. And so we're certainly working on that. A great example for venture capital firms is that most venture capital firms enjoy the so-called venture capital exemption, and they don't have to be registered investment advisors. They can enjoy the exempt reporting advisor status. Yet that 20% bucket of non-qualifying investments keeps getting filled up with secondaries, which aren't considered qualifying. And we have legislation that we've made it through the House of Representatives on a bipartisan basis. Now we're trying to get it through the Senate, and it would move that 20% bucket of secondaries and fund-to-fund activity up to 49.5%. So it greatly increased the ability of more venture firms to, continue to acquire stock in some of their promising portfolio companies, help early stage employees have some liquidity, things like that. So that's an important regulatory issue that we're pushing. There was an effort in the previous administration around anti-money laundering, which basically said we want all kind of fund managers to come up with anti-money laundering programs. And we're like shaking our head and we're saying, wait a minute. This fund doesn't hold dollars, right? It goes and gets a promise from an LP to, when they do a capital call, to send it to them. And then they turn around and they send it to a portfolio company. By the way, in all of those scenarios, it's being wired by banks who have robust anti-money laundering and, bank secrecy, all these rules that they have to abide by. So why is it that you're expecting some venture fund, which, by the way, in 25, the median size venture fund was a little over $26 million. And so you're talking about, for the most part, very small funds on a 2 and 20 model. So when you have $520,000 to, run everything, and suddenly you're going to have resources that you're going to create some sort of program that's going to be helpful to law enforcement to catch bad people, these are closed-end funds. Like I've never heard any one of my members say, I had a guy bring a bag of cash the other day and asked me if he could be an LP. That's just never happened, right? And so these are the types of issues that are just confounding to us. Yet, once again, policymakers don't understand, and we have to be out there trying to get it right.
If I let's just for a moment, I'll play devil's advocate. I make an effort to give people the benefit of the doubt, if only just to recognize, my own knowledge gaps. 40 is a lot of rules. I imagine we can devote a 3-hour podcast to going through them. But look, what's your like? If you had to leave our audience with a take, like, where does that come from?
It comes from treating all private funds exactly the same. So, in their mind, their median fund they're looking at is some giant hedge fund on Wall Street. It's not a venture capital fund.
Got it.
And even if they were focused on venture capital fund, too many of them think about the very largest that they read about in the news. That's not the $26 million fund, it's the multi-billion dollar fund.
It's interesting, as I think whether the answer is ignorance or just being plain old lazy, we need organizations like the NVCA to educate. I mean, Power to you. You touched on a moment ago coalition, and I was going to ask. I would love to, how much coordination takes place with your private equity, hedge fund, private credit counterparts?
A lot. This is, I think this is one of the surprise, most surprising things when I have new board members come on to the MVCA board. And I think because they have seen the success that we have had, knock on wood, hope it continues, they believe that, we just do all this ourselves. And the reality is our industry is tiny. Think about how many people collectively are involved in venture capital compared to any other industry. And so when you think about that and you think about what it takes to sort of make your advocacy case and to reach 535 members of Congress and to, kind of take the arguments up there and advocate, you realize our tiny industry can't do this alone. And so often we are working in coalitions. Example, qualified small business stock, 1202 in the tax code. It is something that is under fire and is going to be under increasing fire. And so we will partner with the Angel Capital Association, and we will partner with entrepreneur groups, and we will partner with, lots of folks that have been involved in 1202 type transactions and benefits. And together we have a much stronger case, a much stronger coalition, a bigger choir to go sing. And that's what it takes oftentimes to make a difference here in Washington.
So for everybody's benefit, qualified small business stocks, a federal income tax exemption, I think it's the first $50 million after holding a corporation stock for 5 years. I'm biased, but I like it. That said, I coincidentally, earlier this week, I found myself in a conversation around the state of New Jersey, which I want to say has adopted federal policy. Curious, how do you have any sense you can share with us as to how often states follow suit, or is it total hit or miss?
This I probably came up the same time with me that it came up with you. So New York was actually you have the Senate and the House and the governor trying to do a budget bill. And the Senate was reportedly going to decouple in their budget bill from the changes on QSBS. Now, what I don't know is, because we actually never saw the draft text, I don't know if it was fully decoupling from recognition of any qualified small business stock benefit or just the increased benefits from the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill last year. And that's a case where we were basically playing offense to have a good defense, except we ended up scoring the touchdown. And so we made improvements, or we had recommended making improvements to qualified small business stocks, so you didn't have that 5-year cliff. And we made the argument that companies might be making bad business decisions because they're waiting for this 5 years. What if we phased it in? So you could have 50% exclusion after 3 years, 75% exclusion after 4 years, and then 100% exclusion after 5 years. And they put that in the tax bill. It's why I say this benefit is gets better. And when something gets better, then it gets a big target on its back. And that's why people are coming out. But to answer your question, some states automatically will recognize what happens at the federal level. Some states have to make a conscious decision to recognize or not recognize. And then there's like a third category of the way when tax law changes at the federal level, which states have automatic triggered provisions or which ones have to go in and decide whether or not they are going to accept it or decouple from it.
Did not know that. It's great insight. I want to be mindful of time. This is fantastic, but I'd love to highlight your professional journey leading up to president and CEO of NVCA.
Well, I grew up in the state of Arkansas and was a proud Razorback at the University of Arkansas and got a degree in finance and thought I was going to Wall Street. In the meantime, right after graduation, I got offered a 6-week internship for a senator from Arkansas. So As I say in speeches often, I came for 6 weeks, and that was what, almost 40 years ago, I guess, getting close to it. So I came to Washington, worked on Capitol Hill, first as an intern. A few weeks into that, a position opened up. I got to work on a variety of topics. I worked on international trade issues. I was in Geneva with a U.S. delegation when we created the World Trade Organization. That was part of the Uruguay GATT talks, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. That was December 93. I was also, I did agriculture issues on the Senate Ag Committee, and that was a farm bill in 1996. So got lots of different experiences on Capitol Hill, which was a wonderful opportunity. I was also working for the senator that was considered the best friend of the then president, Bill Clinton, who had been the governor of Arkansas. And that gave us unique access to the White House and the president, working for a senator who was his close friend. In fact, I got to play golf with the president when he was president, and my boss, who was senator, which was a lot of fun. So I had an amazing time up on Capitol Hill working in public policy and really got hooked. And the idea of going to New York and working on Wall Street just kept getting further and further away. He ended up retiring, and I became what a lot of former Hill staff do, a lobbyist, and went to a consulting firm. We represented state universities and land-grant colleges and did that for about a year and a half. And then I went to work for a company called Alltel, which was headquartered in my home state of Arkansas. It was a telecom company with wireline and wireless subscribers. And we kept having mergers and acquisitions and growing. And, we got to be about the fifth largest wireless carrier, but realized that fifth's probably not going to make it in the long term. And I got an opportunity to move from Alltel over to the Trade Association that represented all of the wireless industry. So I was the head lobbyist at an organization called CTIA. And that one time stood for the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association. It had many names after that. But worked there about 10 years, first 2.5 years as head lobbyist, and then the last almost 8 years as the number two, the executive vice president. And that put me on the radar of executive search firms. And in 2013, I got a call from one, and they said, NVCA. I said, "What's that? I've never heard of that." And they described what the organization was all about. And it really piqued my interest, perhaps from having a finance degree at the University of Arkansas, perhaps just because the more I got to understand about the entrepreneurial ecosystem, the more excited I got about the prospect of representing them and advocating on their behalf. And so threw my hat in the ring and ended up getting hired then in 2013.
Well, I'd be curious to know. So you're in this, don't have an opportunity to talk to people who've had your experience often. What are some of the, as an insider in the Beltway, what are some of the key takeaways, that's probably a good word, that you've had working with the different branches of government, federal government?
There's lots of takeaways. I think, first and foremost, when you think about so-called bureaucrats, and it's certainly the current administration almost has a very negative connotation. What I see is a lot of well-intentioned, well-meaning people trying to do the right thing, trying to serve the American people in the role that they have. And I think it's kind of like the paradox where you see a lot of polls that say everybody hates Congress, but they love their member of Congress. It's this like, oh, I hate bureaucracy, but boy, I love this bureaucrat. I mean, it's that's the one thing that I think is probably misunderstood inside the Beltway. The other is that it's a really small town. Washington sounds big, and that doesn't mean I know everybody in town by any means, but if you're involved in public policy issues, there's just a few degrees of separation from about everybody. And so, one of the things that I sometimes get asked, how do you think you've been successful in this environment? And I feel like my answer is always the same, which is because I grew up in a small town in Arkansas where everybody knew your business and you know your reputation was everything, and you had to think about that. And I think that's helped me here for sure because I see this as one big small town.
So is it fair? I mean, self-interest is in a natural condition for humans. I imagine that plays out at various levels, hence your comment of, we love our representative or senator. And so is it fair to say that maybe there's a, for all the critics of, again, politics aside, of anyone who's in a legislative or executive branch, maybe even judicial, that there's a human component to what we do, and it's like, who are my people, and I have to represent them, and so there's just a lot of horse trading that takes place in order to form policy. Is that fair?
It is fair. It's also when you look at the institution even higher, there's another which is really on steroids right now, and that is that the relative power of the different branches of government. And I think it's everybody would argue in the current administration that the legislative branch seems to be losing its power and the executive branch seems to be gaining power. But I don't see that as a new phenomenon. I see that as something that I've witnessed over 30 something years. And when I first, for example, when I first got here and worked on the Hill, the legislative branch exerted its power well and often. And that comes in the form of oversight, that comes into the form of calling folks from the administration up in front of Congress and giving testimony and putting pressure on them and all this kind of stuff. But it also comes from just doing your job. And getting a budget done and getting appropriation bills done and making sure that you pass legislation and you're having to compromise. Everything was more governed from the center, politically speaking, and that's where you wanted to find supporters because that's how you got something done. And members of Congress had to go back to their constituents and say, I'd like to be reelected. Here is my resume. These are the things I accomplished. Well, the only way you could accomplish anything is if you worked with the other side of the aisle and you did some of the horse trading, so to speak, like you just suggested. That's not there anymore. And we could do a whole podcast on why it is. I would give you the answer that Charlie Munger would give, right? You show me the incentives, I'll tell you the outcome. And the incentives have worked into our system of politics in a way that you're incentivized to be far left or far right. You get more airtime, you get more social media algorithm love. You are rewarded in political ways from being further right and further left, whereas the opposite was true 35 years ago.
You're right. We probably could devote an episode to this. And my fr the engineer in me is like, well, what's the root cause? And I, internet probably comes up more often than not. But to your point, fun fact is if you look back on how the Senate voted for Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Anton Scalia, I mean, it was nearly unanimous. And just, you say that now, and you're like, wait, what?
Exactly.
It wasn't partisan. That's something has changed.
Well, I got there right after C-SPAN had cameras in both chambers and was starting to do it in committee hearings. And I think that had an impact. I'm not saying that, you shouldn't have C-SPAN and people shouldn't see their government at work. I am saying, though, it caused elected officials to act differently when they were in front of a camera. And then you had the 24/7 news cycles where, everybody was searching for news and all these different outlets had to. And that we still see that today, right? And so they're looking for something. And then the people started, realizing that if I act a little crazier, they're going to put me on more. And then I'm going to be able to raise more money for my reelection.
I mean, they're multi-billion dollar companies who've capitalized on attention. It's probably here to stay.
Yeah.
The solution-minded person in me, thinks that transparency may be the solution. Time will tell. So with that, before we wrap up, what's your outlook on the future? How do you anticipate things playing out with the current administration. If you want to comment beyond that, I'm all ears.
Well, I think after spending now the last 13 years with the venture capital community, I've become the eternal optimist that a venture capitalist must be, because if you're going to make all these investments knowing that many of them are going to go to zero, you've got to be optimistic all the time. So I am optimistic that we will find a way to persevere. We will, as a country, get through times that we believe are tough. I'm optimistic on the country. I'm optimistic on our industry. I'm optimistic on entrepreneurs being able to continue to, take big ideas and swing for the fences, and there to be somebody there willing to go alongside them and provide them some capital. So it's hard not to be around this industry and be that optimistic, but I am, even in the face of challenges that we see before us.
I love it. Yeah, I've never seen the logic of being pessimistic.
Me either.
Excellent. Bobby, if there's anyone in the audience who would like to learn more or become a members if they aren't already, how can they find you, or where would you like to point them to?
I'd say our website's the best place to start, nvca.org. That's where we try to keep everything that we're doing. Certainly, we need the support of our industry. We are a nonprofit. And so, if you're in the venture industry, we ask that you please consider joining and supporting the work. You are benefiting from it. You've already gotten the benefits from it. And it takes the entire industry to support what we do, because the issue set keeps getting bigger and longer and more complicated. But that's what we're here for, and we're excited to do that work on your behalf.
Fantastic. Bobby, thank you so much for your and the rest of the team's effort. For those who may not appreciate the impact that it has on just everybody's life. I mean, Apple had venture capital, and everyone enjoys an iPhone today. It's a great example of how the work that you're doing is very meaningful. So thank you.
Thank you.
Bobby, great episode. I appreciate your time. Take care.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.